Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
I'm a feminist, but my husband, Tom Zielinski, wrote a book with his podcast partners called Best Pick that goes with his podcast. It's about the Oscars and about film. And the other night he had a little book launch downstairs in a Waterstones. And when I got to the top of the stairs, the woman said, "And could I have your name, please? Because I need to tick you off a list." And I said, "My name's Deborah Frances White, but I'm the wife of one of the authors." And she was like, "Oh, impressive." And I said, "I know. I'm the wife of one of the authors, a very celebrated man." And I said, "Look, normally he comes along and says, I'm Deborah's husband or Deborah's producer." And I was loving being a wife. Like, there was no pressure on me. All I got to do was admire the man.
Yes.
And just be like, "My husband wrote this book. My husband. And I was really enjoying it, to be honest. I had, like, it was an hour and a half of being Betty Draper, and it was just wonderful.
You were being the first lady of Oscar trivia literature.
That's exactly what I was. And it was wonderful. I was so Jackie O. And I wore quite a floaty dress and I was there going, have you seen my husband's book? Would you like to have your book signed by my husband in the corner? I never really used the word husband very much because I sort of think we're partners and in so many ways.
Yeah.
But I was really enjoying it. I don't like the word wife and I don't really like the word husband either. I find it too grown up for what I am or what I have. Like, I feel it makes me too grown up.
Yeah.
But I'm coming into a space where I'm like, I felt like it was really nice to kind of admire my husband's achievements.
You could call him lit husband, like literature.
Lit husband. Yeah.
Because literature and lit
at
the same time.
These are good suggestions. I'll write these down. Yeah. We've got any more.
Book boy. I'm trying to figure out this stuff. Book boy.
Book boy, I think, lowers his sex appeal.
Yeah, that's true.
That makes him sound like Robin. Like there's some superhero of literature and he's book boy. He just carries the bag. I don't... Listen, Tom Zielinski will be editing this.
We're spitballing.
We're going rapidly downhill.
They are,
yes,
are
indeed.
They?
Indeed.
We need to bring man into this somehow.
Yeah. What do you think? We need to brainstorm this with a man.
Yeah. I'm a feminist, but I need a male voice right now.
Indeed.
I'm a feminist, but I was trying to think of I'm a feminist, but on the train on the way here. And all I began to think of was merchandise. And I think, you know, the way 2000s fashion has come back in, I see a lot of people with writing on the back of their bums on tracksuit bottoms and
like
stuff.
Like Juicy Couture type.
Yeah, Juicy Couture. I'm thinking we could have a I'm a feminist ... written on the back of someone's butt. And it could be a joke of I'm a feminist butt. I just really like communicating through writing on your arse. I want to get a pair of trousers that say help on the back of it. And we'll see how many people answer that call.
What, more like, how's my walking? Ring this number.
Exactly. Which is my number. You were looking.
Bastards.
Yeah.
Listen, yeah. Listeners, if you want Alison Spittle's merch ideas, i.e. tracksuit bottoms with I'm a feminist dot, dot, dot written on them on your butt, then please email guiltyfeminist@gmail.com or DM us and tell us there's a demand for those.
Yeah, I'll do a Kickstarter,
it's,
mate.
It's pretty suggestive.
I would wear it.
I'm a feminist. We've got, dot,
we've
dot,
got,
dot.
We've got merch. Yeah, we could ask butt. For them. We could see if our merch store would do them.
We could start off with mouse pads and then bring it up to...
We how would mouse pads be the butt, though?
I don't know.
I thought the whole point was the butt.
Small. Yeah, yeah, you're right.
What year is it that people have mouse pads?
The same year that people have writing on the back of their bones.
Computer mouse pads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking early 2000s.
I don't know, knee pads?
Well, like incontinence pads for mice. Little ten of mice pads.
I mean, these are all strong ideas.
Yeah, you think we could bring in the little...
I think we need a man.
Strongest possible ideas. We will get back to you, listeners, if any of these come to fruition. But if you do want those track pants, we can ask the merch store what they can do. I'm a feminist, but today I saw a picture of my biological grandmother I'd never seen before.
Oh, where did you
see that? Yes. I saw it on Facebook and I... paired it immediately with a picture of myself.
Okay, sorry, I just hit there because that looks very, very similar.
It's a big cheekbones.
Yeah.
Cheek jazz.
But my nose is the same, my eye shape is the same, my lips are the same.
No, the raised eyebrow expression is the same.
Yeah. I mean, I found my biological family through the eyebrow. And it's true, through the shape of my eyebrows, that's how I found them. And I had a name and the shape of my eyebrows. That's all I had. And I've done a show about it. I never met my biological grandmother because she'd left us before I found them.
Yeah.
But I said to Tom, what do you think? And he said, wow. And I said, do you think we look alike? And he said, yes, but you're prettier.
Well, you would want that.
And I'm a feminist, but for just a second, I felt delightedly competitive with my own dead grandmother. With my own late grandmother, I should say. Let me do that again. With my own late grandmother.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not any better, is it? Like, just leave the whole thing in, Tom. It's not any better. For prettiness, like, we were two girls at high school together and a boy had said that I was slightly prettier.
I'm a feminist, but last week I was going to a hen do in Butlins. I decided to step back into the eyelash perm game again. And I was in a basement in Camden where this woman put this stuff that made it smelled like burnt hair on my eyelashes. Ooh. And she said, please don't open your eyes for 15 minutes. You may become blind. And I lay there with my eyes really shut for about 15 minutes thinking, is the curl worth it? And listeners, it is.
Blindness.
Yeah. I just looked and I was like, I think it's the same way people go abseiling or something like that. There's a sense of danger. I like to do that with my beauty treatments.
So they curl them. I had this done once.
They curl it, yeah.
I let people look. Take a glass of. Yeah, they are good.
Do you think so?
Yeah, they
are good. I don't know, because they were real droopy. I never looked at my eyelashes before.
I'll be completely honest with you. I am 25% prettier with false eyelashes on.
Yeah.
It's such a dramatic difference.
My eyelashes normally, they're like a little celebrity coming out of a hotel trying to hide their identity. Like, it's just, it's like a baseball cap across my eyes.
And they just put their hands up going, no photos, please.
Exactly.
And then, so what you've done is paid a lady to blind / beautify you.
Yes.
And now you see 25% less well, but... oh, my Lord. Those celebrities are coming out as if onto a red carpet in a ball gown.
I'm Lady Gaga at the Golden Globes. Just go and love me, please, you know?
I'm a feminist, but I have a note here in my diary which just says, I'm a feminist, but use feminism to justify pastries. I don't know what this refers to, but I make notes when something happens because I think, you know, I need a lot of these. And so if something happens and I think, oh, God, that's an I'm a feminist, but I'll write it down. I don't remember how I used feminism to justify pastries, but I obviously did. I clearly... Now, the thing that I can think of is I was in Portugal
And I was having, what are they called? Pasti de...
Pastel de nata.
De natas,
Pastel
de nata.
Yes, I was
Pastel de nata. And I can't remember why, but I know I had more than my fair share and someone else's fair share of pastel de nata.
Maybe you took a man's one. Maybe you took like, what's the percentage of that men get paid more than women? Maybe you took that back in pastries.
It's so unknown to me how I could have used feminism to justify pastries, but I must have said something like, well, if I'm not having pastries here, I don't know. I'm denying myself. I don't know. But I clearly used feminism, which is something good and righteous and important, and about closing power imbalances to justify eating more custard tarts.
You're leaning in over the pastries and just sniffing it in.
God knows what I'm doing.
It's because the voice telling you you shouldn't have those pastries is definitely an anti-feminist voice.
Maybe, Matilda.
It's the patriarchy.
That's genuinely anything that's...
Seems like it must be more than that, though. Something happened. It'll probably occur to me in the middle of the night where there was an altercation with a man or something.
Well, do you think, like... I really love your idea of a voice telling you, like, stuff that you want to do. I imagine the voice of a great feminist person, like... For me, like Mary Robinson, who was like the former president of Ireland, and I imagine her voice going, go on, Alison, enjoy it, you deserve it, feck the patriarchy. And when it's someone telling me something to do that I don't want to do, like, Alison, why don't you walk to the shop? It'll be the voice of my nemesis. So it'll be like, Alison, why don't you walk to the shops? Do you know, like,
who is it? Winston Churchill.
Trump. Yeah, Winston Churchill. Yeah, Trump. We'll get them on the beaches. I try to do an impression of.
You don't eat that pastry.
Yeah. Alison, don't eat that pastry. That's my Winston Churchill.
Maybe it was something like that.
I'm a feminist, but I was at a hen party last weekend, and it was in Butlins, and we had a massive inflatable penis, as you do, for the hen party, and I was bringing it in to see Boys Life, who are a super group. Imagine if the best members of Westlife and the best members of Boyzone stayed at home and Keith Duffy and Brian McFadden turned up and became Boys Life. And we were bringing in a massive inflatable penis, but it wasn't allowed in, so I had to walk home on my own back to the chalet. It's about like a half a mile away.
What?
In the dark with a massive penis in my hands. Like, it was as big as me, this penis. And I won't lie, Deborah, I felt powerful. I did do it. I ran into lots of men on the way, and they were commenting on my large penis, and then I would comment on theirs. So
hey.
Yeah, I felt very powerful.
How come everyone else got to go in and see Boys Life?
Yeah, I was the maid of honour, so I had to do admin.
Sorry. Just leave the penis outside and go in.
I couldn't trust people not to take that penis.
Did you need it once the bride's seen it? You just let it go to the wind? I know that's not very good for the environment.
Storm Eunice just takes in that penis.
I mean... But do you see what I mean?
Yeah. No, I
Can't
know.
Can't you just deflate it and roll it up or something like that?
Like a sleeping bag. Are we talking about...
That's exactly how I'm
thinking. And then I tuck it under my arm like a little clutch bag, my deflated penis.
Exactly. And they can't stop you taking that in.
I mean, yeah, that's true. I just...
I would never walk home half a mile. I'd just say, look, this penis has come to the end of its life. The bride's seen it. We don't need it anymore.
I just throw it into the sea like Free Willy. Just let it dive over my head.
And can I say dunk? From an undisclosed location in North London, The Spontaneity Shop presents The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Frances White, guest co-host Alison Spittle, and a very special guest, Matilda Manson and Helena Wadia, talking about next wave journalism. This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and our hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. I'm Deborah Frances White, with me is Alison Spittle, and we're talking about next wave journalism. Yes, journalism for the 21st century, journalism for feminism.
Yeah.
And journalism that doesn't do what it's tended to do in the past, which is to report the story from the POV of the dominant group.
Well, I'm kind of very used to, like, I've stopped watching current event media.
I thought you were going to say Coronation Street then.
Well, I have as well, yeah.
Because you know that's not a journalist programme.
Both reasons, they make me depressed. I used to be an avid consumer of current affairs media, and it would often be just people debating with each other about an abstract concept, but was actually people's lives.
Mm.
And it was coming from Ireland, and there was two referendums, one on gay marriage and the other one was on abortion. And it often felt like, especially in the run-up to the referendum on abortion, it felt like people were arguing about an abstract concept of something that really affected my life.
Mm.
So it's...
they were arguing inside your uterus.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
they
yeah.
were getting up there. You'd watch two men, sans uterus,
yes.
up your uterus.
Yes.
Poking about there, going, as a hypothetical, like looking at it like, you know, they had blueprints, they knocked down this wall.
Is this my new kink? Is this new...
Only you can answer that.
That's suspicious. True.
Only you can answer that. Yeah. But they'd be like, yeah, no, we want to keep it like this. Keep the original features.
Yes.
And you'd be like, this is literally a part of my body. It's on a cellular level, this is impacting me.
Yeah, yeah, it's impacting me. And it also felt like where people would say very, very strong things about stuff, it felt like it was directed at me, even though it wasn't. But it would still kind of hurt the same way. It's like I used to consume a lot of true crime and murder stuff. And then someone close to me got murdered, and I don't consume true crime anymore because it's just a different,
yeah,
you know, a different vibe. Anyway, don't mean to start off the podcast on that, but you know, grade A banter so far.
And this is great banter yeah. about how you can no longer watch true crime because of
annoying.
That's more. A real I'm a feminist but, Alison, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah,
I'm a feminist but because yeah. somebody close to me was killed, I can no longer enjoy true crime, and that's I'm the real victim.
I know, I feel it's a very kind of first world problem.
I mean, it isn't. I can see it being an all world problem, someone yes. being killed, but that's a great example that when something's happened to you, it no longer seems abstract.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, I think when I was younger, there was that, you know, that Heat magazine.
Circle of Shame?
Yeah, like they'd put red rings around people's cellulite.
Seared into our psyches that you just say heat and I'm like Circle of Shame.
Yeah, you knew.
Yeah,
you
straight knew. Away.
Absolutely.
Straight away.
And I think at the time, I thought it was awful, but I didn't understand what it would be like.
Yeah.
Because I was nowhere near in that celebrity world or anything like that, so I didn't have any kind of connection to anyone who that might happen to.
Mm.
And thankfully, I think they've stopped doing that now. And it's not like people are following me around constantly trying to photograph my cellulite anyway, if I'm completely honest. But I can now sort of, because I've got so many friends who are actors and things like that, go,
yeah.
oh my God, like that is a real person with real cellulite.
I know.
And that's so invasive. And, you know, like this is, by the way, celebrity cellulite is not the worst. They're not the worst victims. Again, I feel like I've veered into, I'm a feminist, but let's today talk about proper journalism. And let us think about the thighs of the noughties. Glamour model.
Yeah, I'm sorry I started off with murder.
I mean, I feel I've brought the tone right down.
I'm delighted you have.
I mean, maybe I'm just trying to make it entertaining.
Yes,
and,
exactly,
you know,
exactly.
But you know what I mean? It
I
feels
do.
Like as soon as it's, if we could think about it as if it were, imagine it was your leg and someone was literally shaming it. Like
yes.
going, what's wrong with this leg? It's like, nothing's fucking wrong with the leg.
Yeah.
This is how women have bobbly bits.
Yeah.
And that's just how we are.
Genuinely, since I have famous friends, like I have a friend and she's like, she's doing really well and I'm still in the little green Instagram circle, do you know, the close friends.
Oh,
and
you're
I'm
in
like,
a close friends with someone who's doing really well. You waiting for her to...
I am.
You're thinking any day now I'm not going to see any more of these close friends and I'm going to think
totally.
If I've been dropped.
I'm very much reassessing our friend.
You're not Wagatha Christie-ing her, are you?
No, not at all. No, oh, imagine. This is the proper journalism of Wagatha Christie.
Next wave journalism. That story is still being reported on.
It is.
There's a court case going on.
Oh, there's such intrigue. Now, that's the type of crime I'm into at the moment. It's very low stakes.
So. Wait till it happens to you. Wait, wait.
I know.
Wait till I report to the press something you've said in Close Friends. Then you'll be like, I can't watch Agatha Christie anymore. Yeah. It really hurts. It's very painful.
My basement got flooded, you know, and so on.
I know. I know when you're lying. I would never report one of the lies because I'd know. I'd be like, she's doing this just for me. I bet I'm the only close friend on her.
Do you know, can I just say, I think being friends with you, Deborah, has made me think of Kim Kardashian like a human being. And I think I didn't before. No,
okay,
no,
we need to pause it right the fuck there. Why does being friends with me make you think of Kim Kardashian at all?
Well, because like you are like, you know, the podcast as well, you are famous. To a degree, we can discuss.
There might be, I think, let us be clear about the enormous great big fuck off gulf. The Grand Canyon between the guilty feminist and keeping up with the Kardashians.
Yeah.
I think in so many ways, in some ways I'm very happy about that gulf.
Yeah.
Because it's a gulf of, I think, worthy content. Worthwhile content.
Yeah.
Another way, the Kardashians... They're one of the, I think, only household names now. I think, you know, most people are only famous in a niche.
Mm-hmm.
But I think nearly everyone in the world knows who the Kardashians are, whether they want to or not.
Yeah.
I feel I don't impose myself on people who don't want to know me. I feel like people who find me and find the podcast are delighted to have it. And that's wonderful. And I hope you are. Listeners, I hope I'm not assuming that. But I think I have not imposed myself on the world the way the Kardashians have because I'm too polite. There are many people who don't want to know me, and I'm like, that's absolutely good with me. Like, if you don't want to know me, you won't.
You won't be in a Pepsi ad, like giving a policeman a can of Coke or something. Listen, like that. Would you do that?
I mean, I really, really, really hope that I would never give a police officer a can of Coke, and by doing that, save the world and solve racism. And I say that with the full knowledge that I don't know what she was offered. And what's your price? That's the thing. What's price? If you're offered 10 million quid, it's probably you have to really go to bed then going, I can happily say no to 10 million quid.
But,
so I might go, oh, well, I could do good things with that 10 million quid.
Maybe she was offered like world peace. Maybe it's like the devil has done a deal.
No, I wouldn't do it. The devil's not buying souls anymore, not in this economy. I'd be lucky to have my soul optioned by the devil. At most he would
inflation is gone.
But also just with the pandemic and things, I don't think souls are being bought anymore.
No.
I think it's more like
very much a seller's market.
I think the deal with the devil now is the devil says you need to sell your soul to the public through the memes of Instagram and TikTok. And I will merely look on, laugh, and take 10% of the profits that you get for being an influencer. I think it's more like that now. The devil's more your agent.
The devil would be a great agent.
He helps you sell your soul. I think I once was represented by the devil, but it's only lasted 6 months. Then he dropped me for being a woman. You know, this is all I'm saying. And I think the devil is an agent who allows us to sell our souls to the public.
Yeah.
And Kim's got a much higher price for her soul than I have for mine, let's be completely honest.
But I feel that, like, this is my point. I feel sometimes with your, like, we can debate about your level of fame or whatever.
Yeah, let's not.
Yeah, we're not. But I feel that sometimes people will often take people within bad faith because they're famous.
Mm.
And I think, so I don't do that with Kim Kardashian anymore. I try and think of the nicest reason of why she would do that. And then, you know, keep quiet about it.
And being friends with me has helped you be more generous with Kim Kardashian because you're imposing on her an integrity that you need to impose on me.
Yeah.
Need to? Or...
No, not need to. See. That, yeah, do you get me?
I mean, after the podcast, we're going to need to explore this in further detail. But I think
have
we've
I
gone
talked
as
myself?
Far to the line of me being a parallel for Kim Kardashian in any way, shape or form. Listen, I'm flattered because I know that, Alison, there's one thing I know about you. You are so generous and you would never say anything spiteful. You are only generous in your... You're so kind. And so I know that you've meant that in the loveliest possible way.
Did it come out bad?
No, it's not at all. It's more that I know that if somebody else said,
oh, yes.
You remind me of Kim Kardashian.
Yes.
Because you've taught me to think about being generous to people or something like that. They might not mean it nicely, but I know you could only ever mean it nicely.
Absolutely.
Because you're a very generous person and you really do. You really are. You're a very big supporter of other women.
Well, some women.
No, you are. No, you are. You are.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
Hello, Guilty Feminists. It's Deborah. On the 5th of March for International Women's Day week, that's right, we get a week, we will be in Brighton. And I am very excited to tell you that the Guilty Feminist tour guests for the opening night of the show include Jessica Hines from Spaced and W1A herself and our Royal Albert Hall show, Zoe Lyons off all over the telly and the Guilty Feminist, introducing Sakisa, who is an incredible new emerging comic. Plus, we have both Jess Robertson and Grace Petrie doing music and a very special guest, Laurie Penny, talking about her new book. If you are in Brighton or can get to Brighton, do not miss this show. On the 6th of March, also for International Women's Day week, we're in Nottingham with Jade Adams, Jen Brister, Celia A.B. and Jess Robinson. And the tour continues throughout the spring and summer. We're coming somewhere near you. Go to guiltyfeminist.com and find out where. On the 31st of March, we've got Campus Springtime. If you had a ticket for Campus Christmas, it's still yours. If you haven't got one yet, there's still some left, and all the money goes to LGBTQ plus refugees and also alarming Syrian schools. And for people who've been asking, when are you going to do your Guilty Feminist stand-up show again, Deborah? Well, I'm glad you've asked. All the tickets are sold out at WOW, but April 26th to 7th of May, I'm back at Soho Theatre. So if you saw it, tell your friends. If you haven't seen it yet, it's all about coming out and going in. It's a very personal show. It's one that I'm not going to be putting on the podcast because it's too personal. So please come along, book tickets for that now. I'll also be in Australia and New Zealand with Grace Petrie touring The Guilty Feminist in July. And you can get tickets for all of these things at guiltyfeminist.com and clicking on live. You can join our Patreon if you'd like ad-free episodes and exclusive Zoom hangouts at patreon.com/guiltyfeminist. And now back to the podcast. Our first guest today is a multimedia journalist who's been published across leading national news outlets and the co-founder of Refugee Media Centre, which works to improve refugee representation in the press. She is joined by a multimedia journalist and presenter who focuses on feminism, social justice, and interviewing her favourite indie music stars. She has appeared on BBC Newscast, Times Radio, and on Channel 4's Inspiring Women panel. And together they have created the amazing new podcast, Media Storm. Please welcome Matilda Mallinson and Helena Wadia.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Guilty Feminists.
Thank you so much, Matilda Mallinson and Helena Wadia, for joining us today on The Guilty Feminist. Do you have any of your own I'm a Feminist birds?
I actually weirdly had quite a few I'm a Feminist butts come up this week alone.
Oh, wow.
So
guilty week for Helena.
It was a guilty week for me. So I'm a feminist, but I persuaded my sister not to buy a red dress for her 30th birthday party. Not because I didn't think it would look nice on her or it wasn't appropriate, but because I wanted to wear a red dress.
Oh! For her 30th?
Oh my god.
It's her 30th. She's allowed to wear red. You have to wear any complimentary colour.
But what? My dress is really nice.
What reason did you give her?
Oh, I was just like, I don't think that one is nice.
Well, if Helena's sister, if you're listening.
And she will be because she's so lovely and supportive.
Oh. What's her name?
Ali.
Ali, you go get that red dress. And in fact, wear Helena's red dress.
Yeah.
She's got to lend it to you now.
Yeah, you're going to look like you're in a girl band. I love it now.
Oh, yeah, you could go as twins.
Oh, yeah, she would love that.
Matilda.
I'm a feminist, but as you can see, I've somewhat injured my pelvis. And when I was...
Okay, the listeners at home are not... What are they going to think about
Matilda's
that?
On crutches.
Okay, Matilda's on crutches. That doesn't imply she's hurt her pelvis.
Matilda's injured her pelvis. Mm-hmm. And when I was...
I love that you referred to yourself in the first, like Craig David is injured her pelvis. Craig David all over your pelvis.
I mean, who wouldn't want that?
I know, actually, he's going up.
I mean... I know. Go anyway.
Off track.
Yes. Anyway, I injured my pelvis.
Oh, lovely.
And when I was getting the x-ray and waiting to find out if I had broken my back for the second time in my life.
Yes.
I was just counting my lucky stars that I had gotten my holiday bikini wax before stripping to my knickers for the male radiologist. Because you're lying on the table with your trousers by your knees and your top by your bra, just thinking this could be even more awkward.
I love that you're worried about him seeing your labia, but not your bones. You're like, you can go deeper.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Matilda's like, broke my back once, I'll do it again.
Yeah. Wow. So much to unpack there.
I love it.
Firstly, I do not want Craig David anywhere near me or my pelvis. Okay. Men who speak about themselves in the third person need not apply. Secondly, I mean, I think if I'm completely honest, although I also like a bikini wax, I think doctors have seen it all and non-waxing's coming back. So
they, I know,
they might, when they see unwax, they might think, you know, very trendy, very, very happening, very of the moment.
So really, you're telling me that
very hot.
I should have been feeling self-conscious about the fact it's gone out of fashion.
Every woman should just turn up with whatever she's got going on down there, and every person with whatever they've got going on down there, hair or no hair or somewhere in between.
Yeah,
we should all be confident of what we've got. However, that's never going
to
happen.
If I ever have to get my pelvis x-rayed, I'm gonna make, I think, like a merkin out of like a Brillo pad. Give myself some metallic
cubes. The way you said that was like you were going to go on a night out. Like, well, if I ever get my pelvis x-rayed.
Well, I'm going to go back home.
Saving up.
Yeah, it's a Blue Peter kind of makeup. Where it's like, get some sticky black plastic and some... Yeah.
It's either go to Mallorca or get my pelvis examined. I can't work out. I'm going to go for the x-ray.
I recommend it. I am currently sitting here on opiates for this reason. Is that allowed?
Yes. I love the way that you're like, pubes are coming back as if it's like plaid shirts or something like that.
I mean, how do we know? I will see.
You know?
I just pick it up from the fashion. Just the fashion pages. No, because I know
now.
it's because lots of young women, Gen Zers, don't shave under their arms now.
Yes.
And I can see that. I don't believe they go and have a Brazilian and then leave their arm hair.
That is genuinely my autumn winter season look, though, is pubes. When spring summer comes out.
Well, this is the thing is, I feel if you're Gen Z and you've got, you know, underarm hair and a tattoo or underarm hair dyed blue, everyone knows it's a style choice.
Yes.
For me, if I grow my underarm hair out, it's just going to look like I've let myself go. People are going to be like, they don't think it's a style choice for me, so I'm going to continue to be smooth.
I get you, but I feel like with me, because I keep my armpits hairy at the moment, and I think I'm holding on to bits of youth because I'm 32 now, and I used to get ID'd a lot for alcohol, and now I just want to go up to someone and lift up my armpit. Is this not the armpit of a 17-year-old? You know? ID me now.
Has that stopped? Has your IDing days, are they over?
Yeah, and isn't it? But it's like...
You've got to go to America because they ID everyone there because it's 21 or over. And
okay.
So,
I think I could...
Yeah, I mean, I've been ID'd very late in the day in America and it's a wonderful feeling.
I really want to be ID'd again.
Go to America.
Okay.
I promise you, you've got such a baby face, they will ID you in America.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
Literally go and buy booze you don't want just to be ID'd over there.
Yeah. And a plane ticket to America.
Exactly.
Plane ticket to America, please. I need my self-esteem.
Exactly.
Yes.
Hello. New wave journalism. That's what we're talking about today because... You're two journalists. You both went and did a master's in journalism and started working in newsrooms. What made you want to start your own newsroom?
I think what really made me want to do something more independent in journalism was that prior actually to becoming a journalist, I was working in TV and in TV production. And I was working on... shows, I was going to call them documentaries, but let's be honest, they're not. I was working on shows that were, for example, help, I'm addicted to tanning. I'll let you guess what channel they were on. Yes. But I was working on those kind of shows and I just thought, oh, this is not the stories that matter. These are not the stories that I need to be telling. And so that's definitely what made me want to get into journalism in the first place. And then when Matilda and I were working together in a newsroom at a mainstream media outlet, we realized that we were both struggling with the same thing.
Yeah, for me, there was a tipping point when I had managed to get the green light on a series on multicultural businesses that have been started in the UK by people who'd come here having fled war zones. And then suddenly there was this resurgence in people crossing the channel in dinghies, and the editor pulled the series because, quote, they didn't want to encourage this kind of dangerous and illegal migration.
Wow.
We then proceeded to publish a torrent of articles on channel migrants, not one of which had a single quote from anyone who'd ever crossed the channel or been displaced. Yeah. And I really boiled up. I mean, it's a good thing I'm on opiates right now because I can feel, the monster reviving. But I really flipped out and drafted a letter to the editor, which Helena helped make a little less fireable. and the ball started rolling from there.
I love that, like, you're fantastic, as in, like, I feel that you know you're not perfect, no one's perfect, but you're trying to make the world a better place. You're basically like guilty journalists.
I'm a journalist.
Yes. You are, but I'm a journalist.
I hate the news.
you're I'm a journalist, but it's I'm a journalist, but I hate the news.
I hate it.
I'm a journalist, but I literally hate reading any of the news.
Much less writing it. So what was your starting place with MediaStorm?
So what occurred to me is an issue that affected migrants, and that occurred to me because that's the area in which I specialise. It became evident upon discussion with Helena and other people in the newsroom, this was a very scalable issue affecting lots of groups. So just like people who've migrated irregularly are very rarely consulted in articles affecting them. So sex workers are very rarely consulted. People with disabilities, people who've been through the criminal justice system, people who've been homeless. Oh my God, we realised that that was a concept that had a lot of episodes in it. And every episode would be completely revealing in a completely different way. Mm. We'd be targeting and embracing different communities, bringing something new to very old stories by centering the perspective that maybe should have been centered all along, but by some miracle is missing from most of the mainstream coverage.
And not only did we want to speak to those people, we also wanted to hear from them about what we as the media could do better going forward when reporting on them and on the issues that affect them.
Journalism has in some ways been part of the problem of the story of the world and the way we see people and other people, and has sometimes been an enemy to feminism, hasn't it? Like, can you tell us more about that?
It's hard to know where to start here, but I'm going to start with the concept of balance and how we define balance in journalism, because that's kind of the
hot topic.
The creed, of all journalists is to be balanced. And where we decide balance is still defined by who has the power, who holds the platforms. And so sometimes some of the episodes that Helena and I have done on MediaStorm have struck some listeners as imbalanced because we come from a very different starting point. We don't take the cultural conversation as the starting point. We go to the people directly affected by the issue as the starting point. We think that the conversations we should be having, the debates we should be having, should be determined by the people actually affected by an issue. So, for example, we did an episode on trans issues, and I had some listeners come and ask me why, or maybe they said maybe it was they felt like one thing was missing, which was that we didn't discuss or explain J.K. Rowling's perspective. And I just have to say, we didn't actually talk about J.K. Rowling once in the episodes. I thought it was quite interesting that came up. And when I said that, they were even quite surprised that, oh, why had that come to our mind? Isn't it telling that it feels amiss to have a conversation about trans issues without even touching on that perspective? I just found that very interesting. You know, I'm sure 100 years ago, having a conversation, a debate about female participation in the workplace would have been amiss without asking Freud whether we were going to ruin everything by being really super horny or whatever. But basically...
Which we have. he wasn't wrong.
He was not wrong.
I mean, Alison's already declared her penis envy.
Yeah, very much so. It was a Freud-themed hen party.
Absolutely.
Every hen party is a Freud-themed
absolutely.
Hen party. Yeah.
But like, maybe we think that journalists, we shouldn't be afraid of steering away from debates
yes.
that people think are mandatory, because actually so much of the conversation is taken up by really trivial us versus them issues that don't actually affect that many people.
Like, as a comedian, I think maybe in the past like 4 or 5 years there's been a few news stories that have come out about comedy. I went on to I had moved freshly over to England, and I was asked to go on this really, really big radio show, and I was really excited about it. And they said, we want to debate about freedom of speech and comedy. And I was like, yeah, okay, I don't mind, you know. And it was me and this lovely guy called Arthur Smith, who is a comedian as well. And we're supposed to be on either side of this debate because he's an older white man and I'm a younger white woman. I don't know why you were white. I don't know why I said white for him.
Classic TV debate fodder there. Only white people.
Yeah. But we're different ages.
Yeah.
But we got on really well. We were talking about freedom of speech and comedy. We both came from the same place practically. And it was, I think it was John Humphreys. Is that his name?
Yep.
He's retired. He's a lovely man.
Did you make him retire with your lack of, your lack of polarized fighting?
It's because we were having a conversation and not arguing, because we were just, we were kind of both coming from the same place, which is that, you know, there's an illusion of freedom of speech and comedy. Like, I feel, and you know what? The Daily Mail did a report on my podcast, Wheel of Misfortune, saying that it was terrible that the license fee money was going to a podcast where people are talking about shitting themselves. I get that, like, fair enough. But there was a part of me that was like, where were the freedom of speech warriors in comedy for us then? Like, they come out for people that want to talk about that.
That's a great point, Alison.
Yeah.
Did those angry comedians who leap to the defense of Ricky Gervais say, yeah, why can't these two young women talk about embarrassing moments yeah. and scatology, bodily functions, all of those things? Yeah. But they didn't. No one said anything.
No, they didn't say anything. And when I did the conversation with Arthur Smith, I had one of the freedom of speech comedians get quite angry with me and say that I threw him under the bus. Because when I was getting interviewed, John Humphreys was going, would you be able to do material that's not Islamophobic? He read out the list. Mm. Basically, for context, for listeners, it was a news story, very flash in the pan. They come out every year about freedom of speech within comedy. A student comedy night. They were students. They weren't comedians. They weren't au fait with comedy. They asked a comedian to sign a contract that would say you wouldn't do any Islamophobic, racist, sexist, transphobic material. And he did a joke himself where it was like, well, this is what I would say. And it was that, you know, the joke was, and then that's like his right to do and everything. Mm-hmm. I have no issue with that joke in a way. He was just saying, oh, well, I can't say anything. So when John Humphreys came up to me and said, well, would you be able to do this comedy night? And then he read out all the bits and I was thinking, yeah, I have a bit about pissing into a pint glass that I think is not Islamic phobic or transphobic. Or, you know, I didn't say that on Radio 4, but I was like, yeah, I could do it. Like, I was genuinely, I don't think I'm a better person or anything like that. I was asked a question and I answered it. And it was strange. And I get
it. But Arthur Smith's the nicest person in the world. I've never heard him do racist material or exclusionary material. I love Arthur Smith.
You know, it was great. I had a great time. I got free pastries.
Listen, did you justify those pastries through feminism?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so you know, to be, and you're part of a news cycle there, you know, and it's interesting to hear you talk about, like, you know, your podcast coming from, is this coming from like a perspective of you're not getting people to debate about abstract ideas, it's about people talking about their lived experience?
Well, exactly. So many, especially minority groups, get caught up in those kind of debates on TV and in articles, and they get so caught up in these like unnecessary polarized I'm going to say it, culture wars.
Yeah, oh my God.
You know, what we wanted to do was approach it from the way where those people that are caught, like, in the eye of that media storm, who we talk about them all the time, these people. We talk about trans people, talk about refugees, talk about migrants, talk about disabled people, all this kind of stuff. But do we ever really hear from them properly?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, where they're really given the mic.
Yeah.
And actually, it's what I love. And I must declare my interest in Media Storm because it's from the House of the Guilty Feminist. But I really did want to have you on, and I would have you on even if this was not from the House of the Guilty Feminist, because I love what you're doing in terms of you're really giving the mic. And you're not giving the mic and saying, here's the three questions about J.K. Rowling or about whatever it is. You're saying, what would you like to say?
Yeah, we're not saying justify your existence,
yes.
Right? Which is kind of the first barrier for anyone who has immigrated to this country in order to claim asylum or has been through the criminal justice system. That's not the question that we're asking them. That's not the debate we're having. And we're kind of rejecting where society is in that debate and asking, yeah, what are the questions you think should be asked.
And what's fascinating about this, you're starting from a different neutral.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not assuming that the current debate and where the middle of that is where the seesaw should begin.
Mm.
You're going, okay, let's just leave all of that behind. So many other people are doing that. We don't need a podcast on that. Everyone's doing that. Let's take it over here and go, you pick the question, you say where the middle is, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, which might make us be seen as imbalanced if you have a traditional idea of what balance is, but we have an unconventional idea of balance.
And it's so important to talk to those people that we're talking to with lived experience. It's so important to ask them not only their experiences, but their expertise on the subject. These people are experts, you know? Yeah. You don't need to ask a CEO of a homelessness charity for their expertise and then a person experiencing homelessness for their experience. The person experiencing homelessness has expertise in that subject because they've lived it.
Yeah, normally it would be, you know, if you have an interview with someone who's been homeless at all, it would be, you know, tell us how much you've suffered or how traumatizing is this.
Yes.
Rather than what do you think of the policy? Why do you think this policy isn't working?
Yeah.
And would this policy have worked for you?
Mm. Yeah. I often find that media want your trauma, but then they want you to tell them that you're okay. In order, like, I find out with mental health, I don't know what the best word to say, but, like, I'm quite open about I was going to say journey, but, you know.
Have you been on X Factor?
Actually, no. Imagine going on X Factor and just go, I'm mentally ill. Let's get this out of the way first.
I mean, the mainstream media, the news is not that different from X Factor in that way.
It's
not
that different. Where they sort of try and get you to see, and I know people who've done it, and it is true that the producers will say to people on those kinds of reality shows, could you talk about, you know, we've done some research and we know that you got in trouble for smoking marijuana at school. Could you talk about your drug problems?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like they didn't have a drug problem. They got kicked out of school because someone else had a joint and they had a toke.
Yeah.
But like, can you turn that into a story where, again, you milk your trauma? Yeah. I'm not saying that specifically happened on X Factor. I'm saying that just I know that generally from those kind
it's
of shows.
It's not accurate. Journalism is supposed to be accurate above all. And, and that damages the accuracy of it.
Do you know what, actually, just to go back to X Factor, because there's a big boom in the moment of like people that have been on X Factor telling their story on YouTube, and it's so interesting. That's lived experience. They're experts on how X Factor works and everything.
Oh,
isn't it? It's like
reached an episode.
genuinely.
Can I ask about this turn of phrase lived experience?
Yeah.
Because I don't think everyone knows what it is. When I first heard it, I thought, well, all experience is lived experience. Why do you need to say lived? Can't you just say in my experience? Can you please unpack that? I think I get it now, but I want you to unpack it to see if I've got it right.
Well, so we think of experience often in terms of professional experience in a sector. So the CEO of a race justice charity who is white might have experience in the area of race, but they don't have lived experience. I might have experience in the sector of immigration as an immigration reporter, but I do not have lived experience of displacement.
It's that personal knowledge that is gained from that first-hand experience,
right? So it's stuff you put on a CV is experience.
So is lived experience sort of, in some ways, the expertise you get from living in a world that doesn't support you or that marginalises you at times or that makes you feel a bit sometimes gaslit, like,
because of stake. I think that's it's the expertise that you get from that perspective, but it's also having a stake in it.
Mm.
You have an emotional stake in the issue because it directly affects you. And I think that there's a bit of a myth in journalism that if you have a stake in something, you are therefore partial, you're biased, and you cannot report on it accurately. Mm. But I don't think we acknowledge that not having a stake in an issue is a privilege, and that makes you biased in your own way.
No one's in a vacuum.
No.
No.
There is no neutral. Men in comedy used to look at me a bit like I was fantasizing that it was more difficult for women in comedy, or that we often had to deal with sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And I used to, I remember one time talking to three male comedians. I was the only woman there, and I ended up crying because I felt so frustrated. It wasn't I was sad or they'd triggered me. I was just so frustrated that they were being patronizing to me and going, I mean, if you think that's what's going on, then you live in a fantasy world. Mm. And when Me Too happened and millions of women came out and said that was their experience of being in male-dominated environments, and Me Too was largely driven by the entertainment industry, they can't now deny it. So if there was a similar argument in a dressing room, I would be the one looking at them like, so you're going to disregard that huge structural movement, and they would not have the emotional stakes anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, we'd all had experience of gender politics backstage, but I'd had lived experience of being on the marginalized end of that. They had not witnessed that. And I hear white people all the time going, well, I haven't seen anything racist in this company. Mm. And it's like, well, you haven't lived the microaggressions.
Yeah.
Is it that? Am I getting closer?
Yeah, it's absolutely that. And I think, though, a kind of problem that really good example raises, though, is that it did take millions of women to say Me Too for us to be believed.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, right now, there isn't like this millions of people having a movement about some of the topics we've covered on the podcast, like refugees or anti-Asian abuse. And I think it's so sad that it takes these global movements
because
for lived experience to be believed.
It's people almost flagellating themselves. I feel like when lockdown number one happened and it was like June and there was a big thing on Twitter about the Me Too movement within comedy, I had a breakdown in July because it was just too much. Sometimes I feel whenever I get involved in news side of comedy, where sometimes I can't shut my mouth and I'll talk about stuff because it really annoys me and it doesn't do my career any good. Mm-hmm. Like I should really keep quiet about it. But but I feel like I just feel so frustrated that I have to say something. But sometimes I have felt like that I've not been used as a wrong word, but I feel like maybe sometimes I feel frustrated with talking about your lived experience and then people listening and then nothing changes.
Mm.
I don't want that for other people.
Mm.
Like, I don't want someone that's trans to go on television or something, or an Asian person or anyone to talk about their perspective. I feel that the media, as it is at the moment, is a horrible machine for people. Like,
yeah, so this is a really important point, and this is why the mainstream media definitely needs to represent these kind of minorities as more well-rounded, like, normal people.
Yeah.
You know, when we hear about trans people or you know, any other minority group, we often hear these kind of negative trauma porn stories kind of thing. And, yeah, this is why it is so important that, you know, in this kind of new wave journalism, we learn to represent people as fully rounded human beings.
Yes.
You know, we did an episode on fat phobia, and like part of the episode was about medical fat phobia and how, you know, plus size people are going to the doctor and they're not being believed about their medical ailments because everything is being put down to their size.
Yes.
I spoke to a professor who has created a course on how to treat plus size people when they're at the doctor, and literally the whole course is like, treat them like a human. And it is bonkers that we have to have a course to say, you know, treat this minority group as a human. Yeah. But unfortunately, that is something at the moment in the current state that we have to do.
Yeah, it is bonkers. And that is exactly the kind of argument we're trying to present within the journalism industry. Treat these. It's something that seems so blatantly obvious. You know, oh, maybe when we're talking about these issues, we should be including the voices of the people actually affected by them. Yeah. But if you start looking at articles about migrants, about crime, and you start seeing the voices that are not there, you will realise that we are so far behind that standard when it comes to journalism. So when you say, oh, you don't want to see people going up and talking about their traumatic lived experience and nothing happens, this is where I think the media needs to like steer the wheel a little bit more strongly. Yeah. Because when we do have these lived experience testimonies given, they're put up as one side, one of the relevant voices in the debate, probably against someone who then disagrees. And actually, I think what we are arguing with this new wave journalism is that some voices are more important than others. Some perspectives are more important than others.
Yeah.
And that is the perspective of people with lived experience.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what have you learned? You've now met a phenomenal number of people who we wouldn't normally hear from. What have you learned from them?
So one of the things that we have learned about the importance of prioritizing lived experience voices is that they can tell us very specific policy failings, very constructive ways that we can improve these chronic apparently unsolvable issues that just haven't made headlines. I mean, for example, do you remember the Afghan resettlement scheme that the government got a lot of political clout off after the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan? And they said, oh, we're going to resettle all these people. And everyone was like cheering them. And it was a whole great hurrah of white saviorism.
Yes.
Well, we discovered from speaking to two Afghan sisters who were separated in incredibly dangerous, tenuous circumstances, that this scheme was not operable months after it had been announced and all of that applause had been milked.
It hadn't even opened.
Yeah.
What? So they got all of the claps and everything and the praise.
And it's still not functioning. The sister is still stranded.
تنی هزی که بعدم ای که مرا بهش فروختن مرا پیدا کنم.
Yeah, she's saying the reason that I don't want to go out of my room, I'm scared that the people that I've been sold to them, they find me.
نمیفهم چیکار کنم که بهش دوباره رسم چیکار کنم اینجا اگه نمیفهم چیکار کنم.
She's saying all I know what else to do. I'm just my only hope is to be with you.
That this government pretended to do something and actually did something else.
Look, I know it's shocking, but you know we're here to tell the truth, guys. So
I mean, I would love to hear Boris Johnson's lived experiences of those parties.
Yeah, like, absolutely. I was going to say, to be fair, their party budget's been pretty high. They haven't had a lot of funds to.
Boris Johnson speaks as if he has lived experience when he gets up and he talks about migration and he talks about how it's stupid to get on a dinghy on the Channel. You think, well, clearly you must think you know better.
I'm telling you. If there were climate change in London and he was in any danger, he would be on the first dinghy out. He would be like, you know that man in Titanic who grabs a child and pretends to have a child. Now, Boris Johnson doesn't need to pretend to have a child.
Well, no.
He pretends not to have children. He actually has. But in all other ways, he's that guy on the Titanic.
And then he'd be saying, this is smart.
Just grabs any six children and goes, definitely all mine.
Definitely all mine.
Check it out on Wikipedia. They're all mine.
Another mind-blowing policy failure, which we've just discovered on the one of the most recent episodes. We were looking at homelessness and why it's so easy to fall into it. Mm. I spoke to a woman who left prison and struggled with homelessness. And this is something many, many people coming out of prison, and particularly women, face. By the way, you have literally got women's prisons giving people tents on exits. But basically,
tents.
Yeah. You
because they've got nowhere to go.
Yeah. And they're not such a shortage of accommodation. But then the other issue is, okay, when you come out of prison, okay, it takes 6 to 8 weeks for universal credit to come in. So if you don't have a support system and you need benefits to get your feet on the ground, you can't apply 6 to 8 weeks before leaving prison. You have to apply when you leave prison. So for 6 to 8 weeks, these women have no benefits. They'll be put in, if they're lucky, they'll be put in accommodation, but they still have a fee that they have to pay and no way of paying it.
So when you were in the hostel with other women who'd come out of prisons and had no money to pay their service charge, how did they keep their place in that hostel?
Well, a lot of them ended up working as prostitutes, stealing or committing crime. And the hostel knew about this, the staff, but they kind of turned a blind eye as long as the women paid the service charge.
Can I just ask, as a feminist sidebar, you're really people that I know take great care over language and how people are represented. Normally, I would hear feminists say sex work, and you've said the word prostitution.
It was a discussion Helena and I had because, well, we run our work by each other, and she was saying, you know, is the term prostitution appropriate really now? And we didn't know. But I mean, this is actually a really good example because we're doing an episode next week with sex workers, and we're going to ask them, you know, because we don't have that lived experience.
Great.
And we
so haven't been told. Saying, yeah, we are saying it's not up to us to say that. So next week you'll have those answers because you'll have been talking to. And like, I love the way you really seem to spend time with people and you seem to really go out and find people and not just get given someone a PR agency would give you or you know, someone that's like, oh, Bob's got a mate. You know, like you really go out and find people with who are impassioned and who are experts and who have lots to say. How do you go about doing that? Or is that asking your journalistic secrets?
Well, no, but it's a good question to have because ultimately we want more people to be doing exactly that, going out and asking. It really varies though, because for example, right now what I'm doing is pinpointing a drug dealer I can speak to. That is a very different
method. I've seen that on your Instagram. I've noticed that. Tilda's saying, any chance anyone knows any drug dealers? I promise it's for work.
Knows any, it's not for work for me. Very new to London. I don't trust the stickers on the lamppost. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll hook you up, Alison.
Yeah. Sometimes there's a bit of coaxing involved, isn't there? Because a lot of these communities are very disillusioned with
so sometimes it takes a lot for somebody to speak to us because they've become so like disenfranchised from the mainstream media. And I especially found that, well, in quite a few episodes actually, I especially found that in the episode we did on trans rights, because I think that trans people were so used to being approached for these kind of faux media debates on whether they exist or not.
Yeah.
That I got some straight up no's until, you know, I spoke to them and laid out that I understand the issues in the media and that's not what we're trying to do.
Yes.
We found that
people get scared last minute.
People get scared.
And back out. Yeah.
It's amazing. You're talking about this and like, I just got so many memories coming back. I did an article about street harassment. It wasn't about me being fat, but people harassed me on the street because I was fat. Like, it was a reason of why they did it. And I kept getting called by a journalist for a full week to go on a TV programme to discuss the sugar tax with the Irish Minister of Health. And I'm like, what is this anything to do with street harassment? And the journalist was like, yeah, you can tell him you're not going to take it anymore. And I've got no beef with the Irish Minister of Health or the sugar tax. I'm like, I just don't want to be called a fat bitch on the street.
Their priority there, the fact they're calling you for a week when you, like, harassing you, when the whole thing started with you being harassed, shows that their priority isn't platforming your view. Their priority is them getting their professional
kick. It's entertainment. And it's news is entertainment.
So one of the main focuses of the podcast is asking these people with lived experience experience what the mainstream media is doing wrong and in what ways the mainstream media can improve on their reporting to report more responsibly.
Here's an example. We'll play you a clip with Paul Atherton, who is currently homeless.
Never, ever, 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 ever use the term the homeless. There is no such thing as the homeless. There are people experiencing homelessness. We are not an homogenous group. You know, we have different political opinions, different backgrounds, different, everything is different. It's never the homeless. Because in the minds of the public, if you use terms like that, they will immediately hear, oh, that's them. That's other. That's not me.
It's become such an us and they thing. And one of the biggest reasons it's become like an us versus them is because the us, the people that are in the newsrooms currently, are very often one type of person. And until newsrooms are diversified and not this kind of faux diversity where you're like, oh, we've got a black person, we've got an Asian person. BAME, yeah, cool, I think we're done.
Until it's an
actual level of diversity, including working class people, transgender people, all across the LGBTQ plus spectrum, all across different genders, races, and actual knowledge of the issues, until we have those people, and not those people bought in for an internship on 15K at the bottom for a year, those people at the top, then, you know, this people will still continue to be scared of talking to the media. And it creates this vicious cycle where you just kind of can't come out of it because nobody wants to talk to the media, and therefore those voices don't get heard. And then when those voices don't get heard, we think one certain way. And this cycle continues.
Yeah, because sometimes when I see like two white cis men debating something about on the news, I'm in my head, I'm like, oh, they couldn't get anyone else to talk about this or whatever. And it makes me feel kind of like happy that it's just those two men that are on the telly that people aren't being thrown to the wolves.
This is a thing that we have had said to us by some journalists or some mainstream news outlets, that it's actually very difficult to get these voices because people are skeptical of journalists.
Yeah.
And firstly, that's if you're a journalist, that's literally your job. So I don't think that really, like, I do understand why it's important when we're saying, oh, there are certain people that are not properly represented and stories that affect them. We should say that, look, journalists are under a lot of time pressure. Mm. And, you know, if you're trying to get someone to talk about something traumatizing, there's a lot of safeguarding to deal with. Certain communities are difficult to access. But if you are a journalist, that is literally your job. It's not okay to go and just do a subpar piece of journalism. Give it more time, you know, build the trust, persuade someone why telling their story is something that they should do. And to do that, you have to find out what they would get out of it and actually make sure you're delivering that.
Is this a product of the 24-hour news cycle and the fact journalists are paid a lot less and they're paid just to write a freelance story? And if someone's giving you like 300 quid...
Should I tell you what journalism is if you're sitting on that salary, on that desk? You are literally regurgitating information that is already online in 1,000 different places, rewriting it and putting it up on your news outlet's website so that they can slap their own ads on it and monetize it. You are taking releases from press agencies that give you the basic facts. If you're going to include quotes, it will be a tweet from Boris Johnson, a tweet from the CEO of some relevant charity. You can do that 15 minutes, the article's out. That's how most digital news is done.
Because now we're living in this kind of thing where if your story's 1 minute too late, it's old news.
Mm. Yeah.
But
yeah,
I know, like, The Guardian, we had The Guardian on, and Kath Viner talked about, like, Amelia Gentleman taking, like, 18 months
to
break Windrush. And had Amelia Gentleman not broken Windrush and pushed and pushed. And she said when she first went to, you can listen to the episode, it's on The Guilt of Feminist, but she said when she first went to MPs, no one was interested. Just weren't interested. And it wasn't until she broke the story and made a fuss about it. And a large majority of people in this country went, oh, that's really wrong. Like, that's really wrong. Because it seemed so repugnant to most people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't till that happened that MPs and MPs with cabinet positions started going, oh, yeah, we care about this. Oh, yeah. And Priti Patel's going, oh, do we? Last thing we would have wanted, you know. And it's like, well, you did know about this, but it took a journalist 18 months to break it. Well, clearly, and I'm not saying The Guardian's perfect, and I know people have got issues with The Guardian on all sorts of things, but on that front, had Kath Viner not funded Amelia Gentleman a proper salary for 18 months to break it, it never would have happened.
Yeah, and you do have this slow journalism movement. You know, Tortoise Media is a really great news outlet, and all these leading publications, they will invest in some slow form investigative journalism, but we don't think the balance is quite right. And one of the things with The Guardian and why The Guardian can do that is they have a very different business model that does rely often on funding and donations from supporters. It's less dependent on ad revenue as are most digital news outlets. And so if you just look at the quantity of this short form, rapid digital news content compared to the long form investigations, which are the ones that ultimately make a really constructive policy difference, you know, there's just so much more. There's just, there is just so much of these digital articles. They're coming out all the time and they are fear-mongering. They're sensationalist headlines. They exaggerate the threat that the migrant poses or the criminal poses or the trans person poses, and they don't actually... and they distort the conversation in our head.
But is this because we used to go and buy a newspaper, children, when I was young, we used to go and buy a newspaper and we would pay for the news, literally, and they would sell ads in the news. But the main way that I think they made their money was we all paid for the paper. And now we don't pay for our papers. So now every article has got to also sell bikinis or... Car wax, or health insurance, or holiday insurance, or whatever. And so, if you're not paying, you're the product. So that means, because I have Apple News on my phone, and so it offers me a bunch of different stories, which I pay for Apple News. So it means that I don't have to pay for every paywall because they'll direct me to an article that might be in a publication I don't subscribe to, but about Ukraine and Russia invading Ukraine. So I'll get that. But I find it offers me a lot of stuff on the royal family. And I'm like, I don't click on stuff about the royal family. Why does it keep offering me this? And I think it's because so many people do. And I look at the royal family and like, I think, someone said to me once, the greatest human rights argument about abolishment of the royal family is for those in it.
Yes.
Because their lives are being used... absolutely to sell fast fashion and car insurance as entertainment. And this is not the main reason to move into a place that is, I think, beyond the idea that one family is more special than other families. Mm. But that whole thing of Kate Middleton and Meghan Markle hating each other, it's such, I've no idea, and it's none of my business. Sister-in-laws get on or they don't. I don't know who of my friends gets on with their sister-in-law unless they tell me. It's none of my business whether they do or they don't. But what I do know, it's a confected soap opera to get clicks to sell shit. Every time we click on it, we make it worse.
We talked about this a lot in the Fat Phobia episode, that the very close economic relationship between the media and the diet and fitness industries and the fashion industries, and how that business model works.
They are so intrinsically linked. It is, when you really stop and think about it. So if there is an article about somebody's latest diet or somebody's latest weight loss or whatever it is, and then there is a picture of them, and then there is a link to the bikini that they are wearing in that picture, and then if someone clicks on the link, that outlet gets money. So it is in their interest to promote diets, to promote thinness, to promote clothes, and the
line between digital news and e-commerce is very thin.
What are we going to do now? Because we need, you know, yes, there are Guardian like models around the world. I think the Washington Post has got a similar model, maybe. I don't know. But what are we going to do if the news is now really just a billboard to sell shit, and therefore they need to make the news as newsy as possible? And I'm really careful about what I click on now, because if I click on something because I think, I'll just have a look, or I'm thinking, I probably need to know, you know, as a feminist, about what's happening with Prince Andrew. If I click on that, then I get 12 stories about Meghan Markle.
Oh, and damn. I'm like, it's, you know, so hard.
So... can I ask you, what are you doing at Media Storm, and is anyone doing something similar? They must be. In podcasting, which is more or less a free, ungoverned space, are there any other ways to consume our news? Can you please tell us, what do we do? Where is this new wave of journalism? Direct us.
Yeah, we need some ethical consumption of the news.
Well, the consumers do have power now, because as you're saying, if you're looking at your Apple News app, deciding which story to click on, you are giving information both to Apple and to the news outlets about how to rate their stories. So every single page, we can see how many people have clicked on it, how long people have lingered on it. So for the first time, or to an extent like never before, consumers are shaping the news. Journalists now are not telling people what we think they need to know. I mean, this is a generalization. We are telling people what we think they want to hear.
Oh. It's the last days of Rome. Yeah. Rome is filling while Rome burns.
Okay, here's something that maybe we could do to make it all a little bit better.
Yes, please.
What we're trying to do is promote a greater sense of empathy in the news.
Yes.
And to really try and put yourself in the position of somebody who that story is about. And obviously, you know, one of the ways that that's going to happen is by having the lived experience voices speaking for themselves, is having those people speak for themselves. But, you know, it can also come from the consumer. You can also pull that sense of empathy from within you and think about whether, you know, is this story, you know, developed for a culture war? Is this a real issue? Is this a real issue that matters to certain minority groups? And also, listen. You know, diversify your newsrooms, for God's sake.
But if listeners are listening at home who aren't running a newsroom.
Yeah.
There'll be a few.
Listen, up to 40% of our listeners don't run a newsroom and aren't related to Murdoch. So, listen, what do we do as customer pressure? Because if we are, in fact, customers of the news rather than receivers of truth, if that was ever a thing, which it wasn't, because, again, as you say, it was always the POV of the majority voice, the dominant group. But what can we do? Can we put pressure on our...
Absolutely, yeah. People, journalists are not, on the whole, evil masterminds calculating how to preserve the power structure.
I don't blame the journalists. Yeah, like, if you're there and you're on... Now journalists are paid so little. If you're sitting there on a very small salary and you're being told, get this story out, and you think, oh, I would love to go out and talk to, you know, find and source 15 people who blah, 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 but my boss is shouting at me.
I'm about some of the stuff that has my name on it from the past. Now, the more we do MediaStorm, I think, oh, God, I did that. So first thing, if you read an article or you see a news story on the TV and it's about disability and there isn't a single voice of someone in there who is ever actually lived with a disability, then contact the news outlet and say, hey, I think that might be bad journalism. You know, if you're a young reporter or journalist, don't be afraid to raise it with your editors. So it doesn't matter how junior you are or how isolated a consumer of the news you are, send that message in because someone will see it, and that's how these things change.
I mean, I genuinely have been blown away by MediaStorm, and beyond really, apart from the, you know, first episode, I haven't had any editorial say or anything like that, but I continually get blown away by the things you're saying and the people you're meeting. Can I ask you, what other outlets or podcasts or, you know, even Twitter feeds or whatever, or is there anything else we should be reading, following, looking at? Who do you rate?
Yeah, who do you, the journalists, listen, how do you consume news-wise?
I read every news outlet. I read everything, left to right.
We try and read everything.
Piece together the picture.
And do you have any other recommendations of people who are doing something similar to you?
So firstly, for every episode, we are releasing resource lists
Our social media. Yeah. Each resource list that we release has recommendations of things to watch, to read, to do, people to follow, and advice for how to report on that topic if you are a journalist.
Great.
So, for example, we did an episode on survivors of sexual assault. And in that episode, we spoke to some really amazing people, and they then have their own, you know, either podcasts or news outlets or campaigns or things that they're doing. And so we give, you know, advice for people to see who they can follow and how they can support. Like Leila Hussein, who was on our episode, has a fundraising page for Safe Spaces for Black Women.
Yeah.
Which is really important because, you know, people experience sexual assault in different ways.
So your podcast signposts to other places that you rate. Can we hear your trailer?
Drug-like body shame.
Criminals.
Refugees.
That.
Crazy.
Rape survivors.
Vagrant.
The homeless.
Have you ever noticed that certain groups are spoken about in the media all the time, but never spoken to?
Or maybe you haven't, because it's so damn normal.
Media Storm is an investigative podcast from The Guilty Feminist that starts with the people who are normally asked last.
We've already heard revelations from refugees, Asian minorities, sexual violence survivors, and transgender people.
Our next guests take us into their worlds of prisons, sex work, drugs, and homelessness, and onto the front lines fighting fatphobia and ableism.
I'm Helena Wadier.
And I'm Matilda Mallinson.
And next on Media Storm.
If you tell somebody their whole life that you're no good, what happens is they believe it.
It is disgusting the way they treat people.
He said, and I quote, "I was fat."
All they tell me is what's wrong with me. I don't know any different.
So they wheeled me out in my wheelchair. I was just left there to die.
You become abusive yourself.
Needles were being pushed in, like, more roughly. I was being handled more roughly.
He said that I got myself into this because I opened my legs.
I kicked off like a wild animal because they put me in the shower, six of them, cold shower, washing me, scrubbing me because I was dirty.
The MRI scanners aren't big enough for overweight people.
I've struggled to get officers to speak on the record about what goes on in prison.
We're literally not allowed to.
Advocates do not need to be a voice for the voiceless. We are empowered. We are
stop
magic.
Stop gatekeeping. Stop censoring people.
I would love to know why the media asks the CEOs of a homeless charity anything about homelessness.
I feel really invisible.
Is the media reporting on or creating the crisis?
Plot twist.
It's not, I don't wait for the mainstream media to do anything.
Drug-like
criminals.
That.
Crazy.
The homeless.
Hear our stories. We are the ones who have lived this. Our lived experience is leadership. We are the experts.
It's really simple. Just present both sides of the story.
Follow Media Storm wherever you get your podcasts so that you can get access to new episodes as soon as they drop. If you like what you hear, share this episode with someone and leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps more people discover the podcast, and our aim is to have as many people as possible hear these voices.
You can also follow us on social media at Matilda Mal, at Helena Wadier, and follow the show via at Media Storm Pod.
Also get in touch and let us know what you'd like us to cover or who you'd like us to speak to.
Media Storm, a new podcast from the House of the Guilty Feminist, is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Have you got anything to plug other than please listen to Media Storm and rate, review and subscribe, give it 5 stars, and the more people who subscribe, the longer we can keep it on the air. And I think you'll agree it is a worthwhile show to have on the air. And it's from the House of the Guilty Feminist, so all you need to do is subscribe to it and recommend that your friends subscribe to it and ideally rate it. And it really is worth 5 stars. And I say that genuinely, hand on heart.
It's easier to say it with someone else's podcast.
Yeah, you said it, Alison.
Arrogant. It's worth 5 stars as well.
It's arrogant saying about your own. But
I think The Guilty Feminist is worth 5 stars.
Bless you.
And send us any ideas that you want us to cover, people you want us to speak to.
I already have so many that I'll talk about after. Definitely.
Absolutely. So is there anything else you'd like to plug other than Media Storm Podcast?
Yes, so please follow us on all social media at Media Storm Pod. The other thing I'd like to plug is that I have joined forces with the charities Level Up and Ava to go into newsrooms and to talk to journalists and editors about how to responsibly report on domestic violence. So if you are listening and you are a journalist and you think, hey, that'll be good for my newsroom, please get in touch.
And after I imploded at my former employer, I set up an organisation called Refugee Media Centre. Sorry, this won't affect everybody, so I'll be quick. But firstly, if you're someone who has been displaced and you'd be interested in having a platform in the news, then just search refugeemediacentre.org and you can join our network. And if you're a journalist looking to speak to people with lived experience, we will help connect you to them.
Thank you very much. Both of those things sound really magnificent. Yeah. And I'm really proud and thrilled at the work you're doing. And honestly, I'm admiring of it.
Stop. Yeah, it's been it's been an amazing session. Genuinely, I feel I've learned so much. I'm going to feel weird plugging my stuff now.
Alison, have you got anything world-changing to plug?
Well, I got Instagram at Alison Spittle and Twitter. Also, I'm going to be in Edinburgh this year in the Pleasance, and it'll hopefully be on sale by the time this podcast is out. I'm calling it Wet Deborah.
Wet?
Ooh. Yeah. Wet Deborah.
Wet Deborah.
Yes. I would go see that.
Wet Deborah. I am going This friendship is on very shaky ground.
Kim Kardashian.
I mean, why don't you call it Wet Kim Kardashian?
I should. Well, I was two choices of what I was going to call the show, and I think I've settled on it. The first one was going to be Wet, right? Because it's about aqua aerobics and other stuff.
I'm so excited.
And the other one, I thought of calling it Silent Wetness, because it was about seeing a fight at aqua aerobics. But, you know, you get it? Silent Wetness.
As opposed to Silent Witness.
One of the names when we were brainstorming, name for Media Storm.
Please tell me it was Silent Witness.
To Helena, wait, Silent Witness? That's got a really good ring to it.
And I went, yeah, babe, I think we've heard that before. Very famous television show. I think they're going to sue.
Annoyed.
I think they're going to sue if you use that. Everyone's going to think it's a companion piece to the television.
Yeah, they'll be like listening for that podcast. They'll be like, oh, well, this is quite interesting, actually. You know.
So your show's going to be on sale very soon.
And your
podcast is still going?
Of course, yeah. Wheel of Misfortune with loads of other people. Fern is gone from the podcast, but still in my heart. And we had such a nice time. We went to Northern Ireland about a week ago, and it was good crack. And we've different guest co-hosts coming in. Also, my old podcast, Alison Spittle Show, is coming back. And me and you are going to be in Vicar Street in Dublin. I'm very, very excited about that.
I mean, you know Vicar Street's my favourite venue in the world.
I know. Are we trying to get it?
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Mm. The Vicar Street audience know how to bring a rock concert to a podcast recording.
They really do. And it's on the 14th of March and you all should come. It'll be like a wonderful reunion after the pandemic.
We've got some fabulous surprise guests. We will announce them soon, but yes. You're going to be blown away. You have been listening to The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Francis-White, guest co-host Alison Spittle, and our very special guests Matilda Mallinson and Helena Wadia. Music was by Mark Hodge. The producer for The Spontaneity Shop was Tom Selinsky. Thanks to Rachel Craftman, Gina DCO, and everyone who made this episode happen, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com. Woo! Woo!
Yeah, I just need to get over the momentary imposter syndrome of being connected to new wave journalism.
I feel if I had two men on here who had this new cutting edge podcast and said, tell us about new wave journalism, they'd be like, oh yeah, it's actually a term that we coined.
Yes,
it's really about the movement we've started. We're at the heart of the new wave journalism. Yeah. And we've been described very much as the Watergate breakers of our generation.
The wave is crashing in a water gate.
Absolutely. And whereas what you're saying is, we're not sure it's us, it is you guys. So it is you two. Tell us.
New wave journalism.
Tell us what do you think is new wave journalism and why do we need
it? The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.